Hello, I'm Dorian Linsky.
And I'm Ian Dunn.
We are the hosts of Origin Story, the podcast that unpacks the history behind the ideas, the people and the events that shape political discourse today.
And we are back for season five.
We're kicking off with a two-parter on George Orwell, the man, the work, the ideas. We follow him from Burma to Spain, through Second World War London, to the writing of his masterpieces Animal Farm in 1984, and how their legacy is used and misused today.
That's Origin Story Season 5, coming now from anywhere you get your podcasts.
Hello, I'm Roz Taylor. Welcome to something new from The Bunker. The Bunker Daily, the clues in the name. While everyone is stuck at home, and maybe for a while longer, our regular presenters will be having one-on-one conversations with interesting people from the world of news, current affairs, politics, culture, and inevitably, medicine. We're aiming to start your day with something useful and worthwhile, a bit different from the Punch and Judy show you get on the radio sometimes. The main full-length Bunker podcast will still come out on a Wednesday morning, but we'll be bringing you a bite-sized Bunker daily on Mondays, Tuesdays, Thursdays and Fridays as well. We hope you like it. This has been an extraordinary, historic week for Britain, and the emergency coronavirus bill is one of its most significant aspects. A wide-ranging and, some are saying, draconian bill, it enables the police to forcibly detain you to make you take a corona test. It means mental health sufferers can be committed on the word of one, not two doctors. It speeds up the process of ministers accessing people's private data, and it enables them to unilaterally close borders. It's expected to go through today. Is the government giving itself too many powers, even for a dire situation like the corona emergency? With me to discuss it is human rights barrister Adam Wagner, former of the Each Other charity, of which, full disclosure, I'm a trustee, and host of the Better Human podcast. Hello, Adam.
Good morning.
Tell us, what are the biggest powers that this bill gives the government? You said each part was worth months of debate by itself.
Yeah, it's a very, very extensive bill. I mean, it's 329 pages long. It has a whole range of... It's not just powers, it's changes to very important parts of our society, purportedly for a short period of time, although it started at 2 years and now it's going to be reviewed every 6 months. But as you said it in the introduction, every aspect of this, just to give you an example, one aspect of this is that local authorities are going to lose the requirement to have to assess people for their social care needs and lose the duty to provide those social care needs. That's just going to go. And the rationale is that social workers and particularly local councils will be so overwhelmed by coronavirus and by the response that they simply won't have time or capacity to be able to provide those needs. And that change in itself, if that was coming in a normal period, that would take months of debate, committee stages, there would be amendments in Parliament, there would be social, there would be the public sector getting heavily involved. But this is all going through on the nod. And that's just one tiny aspect. As you mentioned, there's also huge swinging powers of detention, not just for the police, but also for medical staff to be able to detain people. Another really significant aspect is that anybody who is potentially infectious or is infectious with coronavirus can be detained. And in the healthcare setting, that is effectively unlimited. Events and gatherings can be dispersed, as we've been talking about the last few days. And there's a whole range of other powers. And I should say that not everything here, you know, I'm not sort of coming along and saying this is all just a terrible executive power grab. It's draconian, etc. This is in the most part necessary to manage an unprecedented crisis. And it's really important from a human rights perspective to highlight that the state has a very important duty to protect life and to protect our health. And in those circumstances, it's going to need some help in doing that. And it's good that rather than run the risk of doing things which were unlawful in urgent situations. It's trying to get its ducks in a row and manage this in a legal way. But that doesn't mean that everything in this bill will be correct or will be appropriate. And unfortunately, because of the rapidity of the bill process, which has really happened over a few days, we're not really going to know if these measures are to go too far until they're actually operating.
Well, that's one of the things I wanted to ask you about, because one of the biggest problems is we don't know when Parliament or the courts will sit again. So how can we be confident that they'll still be able to scrutinise the effects this bill has?
Yeah, I mean, that's an enormous worry. And you're right that Parliament and the courts are the two natural arenas where this kind of scrutiny happens. So just to give you an understanding of how emergency legislation tends to work. So under the Civil Contingencies Act, what usually happens is there will be regulations made and they allow for all sorts of swingeing powers, but they expire after 30 days unless they're renewed. And Parliament therefore has an opportunity to review what's going on and to make sure that the powers are appropriate if they're going to be renewed. Whereas here, it started as 2 years and it's now been reduced to a review after 6 months. But because of the unique nature of this crisis, it's perfectly possible that Parliament won't be able to sit. You know, maybe there might be an outbreak of illness in Parliament. Social distancing may not allow for the traditional Parliament to sit and without an alternative, and this is quite different to, for example, in wartime. Whereas in wartime, really, what you're worrying about is the location of Parliament, and you could sit Parliament anywhere in theory in an underground bunker somewhere, but because of the nature of this crisis, we are going to struggle potentially for Parliament to sit or to sit in its full form, and then in relation to the courts, well, obviously, there is a huge range of powers here which you would ordinarily see potentially challenged in the courts on an urgent basis. So, for example, someone who is being detained unlawfully, they would say in a medical setting or by the police, you know, they might want to seek an urgent judicial review. Equally, the government has a power to shut an airport or any port for 6 hours at a time, just effectively on the discretion of a minister who sees that there's some sort of public emergency relating to that airport. That would be a power which would be ordinarily the pressure valve, the pressure release would be by way of judicial review. So the owner of the airport could, or the administrator of the airport could take the government to court if that decision is unlawful. But we don't know if the courts will be running. We know, and I mean, the courts are in absolute chaos at the moment as to, you know, people are not able to come into court. So they're trying to do things by video link, but it's completely untested technology. I mean, the Supreme Court ran its first hearing by video link yesterday, and it was pretty extraordinary in any event. But it really does remain to be seen whether the courts will be able to function in the way that we would expect them to run, whether video and phone is going to be an adequate replacement for in-person hearings, whether the judiciary itself will manage to stay open for business, if I put it like that, bearing in mind that it's not a young group of people. They're going to be disproportionately at risk from this virus. They will be, people will potentially be self-isolating. You know, we're reliant on an internet service and internet providers to keep things going. So it may all be absolutely fine, but there's lots and lots of potential issues coming down the line from this legislation and the scrutiny of it.
Yes, I hadn't thought of that, because of course most judges, senior judges, are over 60, aren't they?
I don't know the figures, but I'm guessing, and there is, you know, judges are there are plenty of slightly younger administrative court judges, who are the judges who will be handling this stuff. It's the appeal court judges tend to be older, yeah. because they're more senior. So in the Court of Appeal and the Supreme Court, I think you're finding it's a pretty, you know, older group of people. So you, and don't forget that the administrative court decisions are only the first rung.
Yeah.
So although most judicial review cases happen there, but if you're going up to the appeals, who knows what the capacity will be? And the Supreme Court only has a small group of people who are actually judges.
And am I right thinking this makes it easier for MI5 to conduct surveillance, doesn't it? Because the government will be able to appoint what they call temporary judicial commissioners to approve or turn down the requests of the Secret Services. Why might they want those powers at a time like this?
Well, the justification for that is that so this relates to the Investigatory Powers Act, which is how a number of functions relating to the security services happen through this kind of secret court called the Investigatory Powers Tribunal. And I think the point of this ability to appoint temporary judicial commissioners is that I think the government see that court as important enough that they, if it stops running, it could impact on, it could be detrimental to national security. So if all the judges are off sick, then they will need to be able to appoint judges.
The mood in the country, and especially the centre and left, seems to be in favour of strong and decisive moves. And usually it's the right who are complaining about this. Should that worry us when progressives are in favour of draconian legislation like this? Or are you reasonably content that we're getting the balance right?
I think this is the time where human rights become really important, because one of the central realizations after the Second World War, which led to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the European Convention, and the very significant other treaties and agreements which came afterwards, was that during times of extreme crisis, and we've never had a period in history like the first half of the 20th century for extreme crises ranging from the Spanish flu epidemic to the two world wars and the Holocaust. That when those crises happen, societies tend to close in on themselves and look to a kind of strong and decisive leader who can do strong and decisive things because people are scared. And I think what you can see from this crisis, not dissimilar to the days and weeks after 9/11, is there is an almost universal acceptance across the political sphere that there will need to be strong and decisive things done. You know, let's have curfews. I've seen a lot on social media of, oh, thank God we've now got these swinging curfews and restrictions. God, I was really waiting for those, and now we've got them. I think that is a very natural response to fear and to a crisis, and quite often it's the right response because, you know, there's an understanding that things have to change, that we're going to have to make sacrifices, that things will have to be different for a while, and that is very much reflects the devil's bargain you make after a huge terrorist attack where civil liberties are ebbed away at. But I think that for me, as a human rights practitioner, that rings alarm bells. I am alarmed when I see 93% of people supporting very, very significant changes to the way we live and restrictions on the way we live, even if those changes are being done across the world, really. Maybe even more so if they're being done across the world, because it feels like there is such a consensus over what needs to be done that there may be a slight reduction in our critical understanding of what is being done. And I think the way that you approach that from a human rights perspective is to say, look, these are clearly extraordinary times that need extraordinary measures, just like after a huge terrorist attack. But that doesn't mean we can turn, switch off for these weeks and months our ordinary critical faculties. So we shouldn't just be saying, oh, well, the government is the government is saying, right, we're going to need to turn off social care requirements for local authorities, or the government is saying we're going to need to provide pretty much unlimited and non-time bound powers of detention for medical staff in hospitals. Now, those powers may well be necessary, but it doesn't mean that they are perfectly calibrated or correctly calibrated.
Yeah.
And we have a lot of experience of these kind of, you know, of these kind of powers in these settings and in other settings, and we know certain things are true. For example, that when powers are given, they can sometimes be hard to take away because local public authorities can get used to them. We know that it is almost always better to have regular and quite regular scrutiny in quite short periods, with quite short gaps between periods by Parliament, and easy access to the courts, who can in real time pretty much analyze and critique particular decisions if they are impacting in a way which is disproportionate on individuals or groups. So with all those provisos, I think there is a worry that this is all being put through on the knot, and that the consequences we have to pick up the pieces later. But there is also the we've got to be the ones who are the slightly annoying fly in the ointment to make sure that things are done properly and that we don't miss things out.
Yeah, because I've also been amazed by the speed with which public opinion has, or at least Twitter public opinion, has got behind these measures. And it's
not necessarily the same thing to me
that we are now perfectly, you know, I think some people are quietly struggling with it, but are perhaps being told that they shouldn't be, and so being quieter than they should be. And while undoubtedly many of these measures are necessary, I think you're absolutely right, we have to keep watching them very closely, because even if they are necessary, or some of them are necessary in the short term, looking at them and scrutinizing them is absolutely, absolutely imperative, isn't it?
I think that just one other thing I'd say is that there is something quite unique about this crisis, which is different to terrorism and other natural disasters that we've experienced. And it's this, that generally with human rights law and good public administration, you should only do what's proportionate, which means you should only do the least that is necessary to achieve the aim you want to achieve, and no more. So don't use a hammer to crack a nut. But the problem here is, because the science is so, first of all, difficult to understand, and second of all, unclear as to what is about to happen. You know, is this going to be a virus that potentially kills millions of people? Is it going to be a virus that kills thousands of people and will peter off in a few weeks' time? Or will it be with us for a year or two or even longer? You know, because there is such enormous variation in the potential risks, it's very, very difficult to decide what a proportionate policy would be, because we simply don't know, and the scientists don't know. They can all make their best guess, and we're guided by their best guesses. But we're not scientists. I say we lawyers are not scientists. I mean, in fact, the public authority, the Prime Minister and the ministers around him are not scientists either. So there's a slight, there's an unknown right in the middle of all this, which makes things extremely uncomfortable in terms of setting policy. Because in theory, if the worst case scenarios are about to happen or potentially going to happen, then there is a real justification for very, very significant changes to the way we live, to our economy, to our you know, private lives. But if the effects are going to be much less, then there arguably is less justification for those kind of changes. So in those circumstances at the moment, I just find it's very, very difficult to gauge what the right and proportionate reaction would be. And I think people find that rightly difficult to process.
That's the end of this first edition of the Bunker Daily. There's a good explainer of the bill on the Each Other website. I'll tweet the link to it for anyone who'd like to follow that up. Please do follow us on Twitter, BunkerPod. That's Bunker_pod. And if you haven't heard it yet, listen to yesterday's full-length episode of the main Bunker show. And there's a two-part special edition of the Better Human podcast that Adam has done, which is out now if you'd really like to get into the detail. We'll be back tomorrow with another Bunker Daily. Remember, there is a world outside your window, but it needn't be a world of dread and fear. Well, not entirely. Thanks for listening.
The Bunker Daily was presented by Ross Taylor and produced by Andrew Harrison. The assistant producer was Jacob Archbold, and audio production was by me, Alex Rees. The Bunker Daily is a Podmasters production.